What's it like to live on earth? What are the people like who live on earth? If we were to ask the people who live on earth, what are you like? What are your characteristics? We might get the kind of information that we see from time to time, and that is, we're an age of progress. We are people who get things done. We would cite accomplishments. We would quote statistics. We would see how that we have called out the best from mankind, and based upon some of the things that we have been able to do as human beings, we would predict our future. And the prediction we would make would be, if we weren't pessimistic fools, they would be optimistic. The light is at the end of the tunnel. Deliverance is near. We've almost done everything that we have set out to do. Equality, justice, fraternity, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But if we were to ask God, what are the characteristics of the age in which men now live? Would the reply of God be similar to the reply of men? This morning, as we look at 2 Timothy chapter 3, the first 9 verses, and we may not look at all of these verses this morning, but certainly we will be looking at them from the viewpoint of gaining knowledge of what our age is like. And Paul writes to Timothy, "This know also, that in the last days perilous times shall come." Most of the time we have looked upon this statement with the idea that prior to the coming of Christ, in those last few years, just before the end of all things, then the world will be populated with people who possess these characteristics. So we've always looked upon them as in the future, unless we became angry with our age and applied them to the people who live now in this world. This is not the information that Paul is giving Timothy. Paul says, "This know also, that in the last days perilous times shall come." Paul said, "Timothy, I want you to realize this, that in the last days," eschatos, that which concludes anything, "perilous" are hard to bear, difficult to endure. Timothy, I want you to know this. I want you to really come to a full realization of this truth, of these facts, that in this last dispensation, in this age that will conclude man's activity upon this earth, there will be times that are difficult to live in and live through. And these were the kinds of people who lived in the days of Paul, and these are the kinds of people who surrounded the work where Timothy was endeavoring to serve God. And these are the characteristics of those people who lived in the Middle Ages, and these are the characteristics of those people who live in this age in which you and I live, in this time frame of God's working with humanity and in humanity. We live today in these circumstances, in these difficult times, in these hard days. These are the characteristics of the humans who live in the world right now. They lived in the days of Timothy. They lived in the days of Martin Luther. They lived in the days of John Wesley. They lived in the days of our Baptist forefathers. And they live today. And we see our age, first of all, through the eyes of God, through the revelation of God. And when we see our age through the eyes of God, then it is not difficult for us to realize that what we're seeing with our eyes is a total reflection of the revelation of Almighty God. These difficult days in which Timothy lived, and these difficult days in which our forefathers lived, and these difficult days in which you and I live, they're not days that God has caused. If our philosophical bent is toward cause and effect, we will not say that God caused the days in which we live to be as they are. But someone or something has caused the days to be hard, difficult, trying days in which men live. Of course, we can say Satan has caused this. And when we blame Satan for sin, we will never be wrong, but we must also look at ourselves and accept responsibility for what we do. And the difficult and trying days in which men have lived and are living now in this last dispensation, they are days that are caused by men. Men who have thrown off the restraints of God's law, and men who have thrown off the restraints of civil law, and men who have loosed themselves, who have cut the cord themselves. God never cut us loose. He has given us moral law. He's given us spiritual law. He's given us civil law. We have cut ourselves and loosed ourselves from the restraint of law. And it didn't happen in our particular generation only. It has been going on for centuries. These are the characteristics of the last age. And they're caused by men who cut themselves loose from the anchors of law, and therefore become lawless. Paul begins in verse 2, a somber enumeration of those characteristics by which men are identified who live in the last days. And Paul starts, I suppose, where we ought to start, and that is in the heart. For men shall be lovers of their own selves, psychologically described as narcissism, self-love, autos, automatic. Automatic love that springs toward ourselves from ourselves. We are auto in the sense that we take love from our heart and bestow it upon ourselves, and take the love that is bestowed upon ourselves and then apply it to our hearts. We really are totally self-contained lovers. Of course, not physically so, but emotionally we have love that we bestow upon ourselves, and when this love is bestowed upon ourselves, we reciprocate by loving ourselves more. So from our hearts, there begins a cycle of love that never spills outside of ourselves. All the love that's generated is from the heart of a man who passionately then bestows that love upon himself. So there is the cycle. It never spills over to another human. It never spills over to another thing. It is self-love for me and for me only. Oh, I might touch a family member from time to time with a little bit of kindness, but it's not the love of God. It is not the love of Jesus Christ. It is not the love of the Holy Spirit. Men will become utterly self-centered. And what is the psychological emphasis of our age? It is to raise self-esteem. And I know there is a psychological principle that is defined as self-esteem. I realize that. But I think really, we are actually teaching people to love themselves, and we're calling self-love self-esteem. So when we're saying, let us do the things that heighten self-esteem, we're saying, let us legitimize the things that are caused and created by self-love. Self-love. Me first. And not only me first, but me second, and me third, and me fourth, and me fifth, and me sixth, and me seventh, and me eighth, and me ninth, and me tenth, and then get into the negative and minus numbers, and never will there be a time when it is me. If it is me and others, it'll always be me and others. It'll not be others and me. It's a self-centered kind of deep attachment to one's own interest, to what one wants, to what one is willing not to settle for, but is willing to punish himself to get it. Can you imagine the devastation of self-love? Can you imagine how blighted families would be when each member is filled with self-love? Can you imagine what a family is like when a father is a self-lover? Can you imagine what a family is like when a mother is a self-lover? Can you imagine what a family is like when the children are filled with self-love? Can you imagine what a family would be like filled with those in their room, seeking only their own interest and fulfilling their own desires and heaping love only upon themselves? Can you imagine the conversations? Can you imagine the hostility? Can you imagine the anger, the disappointment, when each member thinks only of himself, loves only him or herself, and seeks only to please him or herself? Can we imagine the confusion? Can we imagine the desolation? Can we imagine the absence of joy, the absence of peace? Can we imagine the absence of any good thing ever being accomplished? Of course we can. We see it all the time. Father has his interests and they're selfish. Mother has her interests and they're selfish. And Junior has his interest and he sits in his room and pouts because he can't have the things that he wants. And Sis does the same thing, and Auntie's the same way, and Grandfather's the same way, and Grandmother's the same way. And we have precipitated by our own evil insides this kind of Me Too-ism that is hedonistic. It stems from hedonism, as we'll see in the Scriptures. And here is society just wallowing in itself. Covetousness is simply a desire for more. It can be a passionate desire for more that tramples on everything and everybody who stands in the way. It can be a pacifistic covetousness that simply sits and says, I want more, place more in my hand, put another check in the mail. It can be that kind of passive manner of wanting more without wanting to earn more, but it may be that tiny mole of energy that cranks itself up to high pitch and rolls like a juggernaut over every human and every human institution and every person that gets in the way. We call it climbing the corporate ladder. Or getting ahead by any means possible. There is no deed so evil. There is no restraint so holy. There is no person so needy. There is no thing so sacred that we would not trample it, we would not destroy it, we would not pull it down and use it for another rung to climb higher. Covetousness. The word translated covetous here means money lover. Look, self lover. And we're going to find that most of the words and terms that are used in these next nine verses are that these next nine verses are based upon have to do with self. That have to do with love. Money loving. There's a difference in wanting things that we can use, desiring things that are profitable for us and for our families, and having a desire for those things that are helpful and make life easier, than an inordinate, deep and abiding covetousness and love for money that overrides every other consideration of life. We see a competition all the time. And I'm not talking about, quote, the free enterprise system. There's no such thing. It costs us all a lot. But competition, entrepreneurship. I understand a little bit about economics. The open market, the free market, competition. What Paul's talking about is a human characteristic. He's talking about a character flaw. He's talking about the heart of a person who is immersed and absorbed in the pursuit of the almighty dollar. The person will always put making that buck first. It'll be before anything and it'll be before anybody. And it is the most important thing in their life is to get that dollar. Maybe not to spend it, but to save it. Maybe not to save it, but to spend it. But it is the highlight of life. It is the passion of their existence. It is the reason that they are able to function is their love, their passion for the almighty dollar or ruble or whatever coin is used. It's to this that they find themselves inalterably attached. It is what they get up on Monday morning for. It is what they strive for late into the hour. Or it is what they sit passively and ask for. Give us more. There is never 1 ounce of satisfaction. There is never a statement there that is made. It is enough. There's never a look of gratitude and expression of thank you. Why? Because I haven't had enough. And if you poured $1 million in pure gold at their feet, they would look into your face with a questioning expression and say, is that all? And they would grab it and count it and stack it and put it away and then say, when? When will you give me more? When will I get more? Would we not expect that characteristic to be found in those who love themselves. Boasters. A braggart. One who boasts about his accomplishments and overstates them in order to impress others. How long was the fish you caught? How much did it weigh? What exactly did you say to that person when they offended you? Shall I exaggerate my adjectives in order to show to you what a person I am to not let anyone else trample on my feelings? What is it that we said to the boss that no one heard? That we talk about around the water cooler? What is it that we told the little woman when we left this morning, making sure she never hears about what we say? On the school ground, what is it that we tell other children our age, our peers and contemporaries? What is it we tell them in order to impress them with our importance, with our strength, with our power, with our expertise? Whether it's a Wall Street bond dealer who out of self-love, covetousness, is able to boast and brag and then expand anything he's ever done in order to create a circumstance of awe and admiration, whether it is the most ignorant person who simply over-inflates his capability in some of the most rudimentary activities. It is boasting. It is bragging. Proud. Probably the best synonym for this King James word is arrogance. We, I think, admire arrogance. We call it oftentimes, if we're not careful, a can-do spirit. And I admire, and I'm sort of admitting my own confusion, we admire those who are willing to say, we can do this, I can do this, I can accomplish this, I can take this and I can produce that. And such an attitude is the attitude that has driven the machinery that has produced the great system of life that we enjoy in America from the viewpoint of all the material things that we possess. People who were aggressive, people who were self-confident, people who were willing to say, I can learn and I can do and I can perform. But sometimes it crosses far over that line and becomes a haughty, proud arrogance in one's ability, in one's family, in one's whatever. Blasphemers. Blasphemy generally is applied in Scripture to speech against God. Blasphemy usually has in it the idea of abusive speech. Satan himself is known as the great slanderer, one who slanders not only God, but slanders God's people. It springs from that which is mercenary, that which is boastful and haughty and abusive. So, where covetousness is in a man's heart, and boasting is in a man's words his overestimate of himself, blasphemy has to do with our language and attitude that we direct toward God. we may blaspheme God by the things that we are not afraid to do, by the things we're not afraid to say. I will not even expose myself to the irreverence and ignorance and blasphemy of some of the so-called entertainment groups that exist in our world, but I think you can see in them and in their attitude an attitude of seeing how far I can go in my blasphemy against God and the Bible and the things of God and the things that God's Bible teaches us not to do. I will show so radically how I fear no God, how I have no respect nor reverence for God. I will demonstrate it by the speech that I make, by the actions of my hands, by the things I will involve myself in. I will show you that I do not fear God, that I am not intimidated by God, that I do not believe God. You know, people oftentimes say these things not realizing they are also expressing the fact that they do believe there is a God, but they're going to show you He's not as powerful as He says He is, that whenever He speaks of holiness, they do not have to abide in holiness. And when God speaks of those things that He will punish, they do them. And then impudently, with arrogance and blasphemy, say, "See, I am alive. I didn't do what God said. In fact, I did opposite of what God did. I have urinated upon the cross. I have done everything I could to show my disrespect and my anger and hatred toward God, and see, I stand here without correction. In fact, I've done this and gotten wealthy." Blasphemers. Disobedient to parents. How do you talk about this without marking yourself? How do you just say that, disobedience to parents, without having young people and children just sigh, or even older people just sigh and say, "There they go again. Boy, don't they hammer on that stuff. Hey, I mean, you know, here they are, disobedient to parents. It's whatever parent says, you know. Golly, can you guys ever get off that theme? Don't you ever get tired of that stuff? Can't you find something positive? Why do you just dwell and wallow in the negative? Disobedient to parents. I guess you mean those old kind of parents that want you to do right, where a father is more interested in the purity of his daughter than her success. Where a father or mother is more interested in the purity and the virginity of their child than they are their popularity. You mean that kind of old-fashioned stuff that lays down barriers, that develops rules, and keeps us all out of the good stuff we'd like to be involved in? Are you talking about that kind of silly stuff, preacher? No, I'm not. I am not talking about that kind of silly stuff. God is talking about that kind of silly stuff, and He's talking about it 2,000 years ago. So don't blame me for bringing this up. Don't look at me and say, "Are you caught up in that old-fashioned, that old puritanical kind of morality that even believes that parents ought to have authority and that children ought to be subject to it? You probably even believe that we ought to obey the laws of our land, don't you?" Yes, I do. So, color me puritanical. But you know, I think I would be this way. I think I would have the attitude and beliefs I have about this world if I had never read these verses in the Bible. And do you know why? I think I would passionately believe the things that I believe for no other reason than the experience that I have had and that I have shared with others who have lived in this world. Because I think, and let me say this reverently, that if there is no God, the best way is still the way of obedience. It's your best choice. It's your best choice. And disobedient to parents, unwilling to be persuaded, that's literally what it means. A person who will not let their parent or parents persuade them. It is that same old heart that has said since the descendants of Adam and Eve, especially Cain, who could not be persuaded and slew his brother Abel, it has been that same old attitude of, my parents can't tell me what to do. And they can't. They really can't. I agree with you. Your parents really can't tell you what to do. In fact, when you grow up, not only will you be able to say, my parents can't tell me what to do, you'll be able to look in the policeman's face. You'll be able to look in the principal's face. You'll be able to look in your employer's face. And with the same petulant gaze, say, you can't tell me what to do. And you could live your whole life in that glorious atmosphere of happiness and independence. It's a wonderful way to live. I see in the lives of those who say, my parents can't tell me what to do, my teacher can't tell me what to do, my principal can't tell me what to do, my employer can't tell me what to do. I see in these people the most blissful of circumstances. The most joyous people in all the world are these people who can't be told what to do. In fact, they will even lift their arrogant, blasphemous eyes to God and say, God, you can't tell me what to do. And so with no one to tell them what to do, they think they become the adventurous human of Huckleberry Finn floating down the river of life, just sort of untainted by the time clock, unrestrained by laws, camping out in the open, just enjoying life. But these are the people who have flooded our prisons, who are the main consumers of drugs, who drink the most alcohol, and incidentally, who cry the most tears. Unthankful. Just literally ungrateful people. They may say thank you, but it's good politics. It's good PR. Culturally acceptable. An excellent way to break off a conversation you're bored with. Well, thank you. I've got to go. Thank you. You know, just words tripping off the tongue like dew dripping off the eave of the house, without much aid to the dry ground, and yet making quite a bit of splash over it, quote. thank you. Little kids, thank you. Oh, we're training them right, aren't we? Now they say, thank you. That is great. It's wonderful here. Thank you. But we may teach people to say thank you, but teaching people to be grateful is another thing. Truce breakers. One who will not make a truce to end hostility. Seen the new TV program, Civil Wars? Really funny, isn't it? Just a real hoot, isn't it? Just people who won't shut up, people who won't end the fight, people who won't end the quarrel, just people who go on and on and on, trying to sink one another's ship, trying to burn one another's bridge, trying to put one another out of existence, trying to nuke in on the other. Civil wars, just absolutely intractable, unforgiving. I'll carry the hatred to my grave, and no matter how many times you say I'm sorry, how many times you make an apology, no matter how many times you make an explanation, I will go to my grave with hatred in my heart. I have unforgiveness. I will protect my unforgiveness, and I will carry it with me. There's no truce that will ever be made by those whom I direct my anger toward. No truce. Just like those people who are angry and fighting in Sarajevo, no truce. You kill me and I'll kill you. You kill my wife, I'll kill your wife. You kill my children, I'll kill your children. You bomb me, I'll bomb you. Isn't it wonderful? Aren't we having fun? Isn't it a great way to live? I'll starve you to death, you starve me to death. I capture you, you capture me. I torture you, you torture me. And we'll just feed on human flesh, and like the two cats hung over a line who just fought themselves out of existence, we'll just destroy ourselves. But brother, there's one thing I won't do. I'll not make a truce. Most of the time we forget what we got mad about in the first place.